Afternoon. It's Tuesday, May 6th, 2025. I am Zach Barnett. To my left, on your right, I might have that backwards. It doesn't matter. The beautiful face of John Bryce. We are the Football Scoop Podcast, back with a special edition. John, how are you?
I'm good, Zach. Happy day after Cinco de Mayo. Hope that you celebrated appropriately with your fine family.
I did not have a single item of Mexican food yesterday. How about you?
I grilled fajitas. I had some beer chicken fajitas, some barbecue chicken fajitas, and some steak fajitas, as well as some grilled corn on the cob and some refried beans. So we paid our proper homage to Cinco de Mayo in the Bryce household.
Okay, I need some steak fajitas now. Anyway, we're not here to talk about your delicious steak fajitas. You and I were both in Frisco, Texas this past weekend, or late last week, excuse me, where we were right in the I like this event because when it goes on in this Omni Ballroom in Frisco, Texas, we're in the center of the college football world for those 2 days, or you were there 3 days. So what was the center of the college football world, John? Where were we?
Yeah, we were in Frisco, Texas, at Dallas Cowboys headquarters, the Star. And I told people who asked me about this, other colleagues, and honestly, I shudder talking about it this much, Zach, because you and I both know how dang fruitful it is for us to be there and how enlightening it is. And finally, I had so many people asking me, why are you going down there? And I just said, because it will help me do my job better the entire rest of the year. And as noted, you've got a great piece out on the preseason top 25 right now at Football Scoop. But I just think that this event in particular is so educational for everyone, and certainly the directors of football operations throughout college football, and even some high school reps there this year, as well as people from the NCAA. Those people are the actual spine, the central nervous system of any college football program or any football program. And to get to be in a room with them and to learn and to see the issues that every school across the country is tackling, to see how much transparency there is among one another, because as more than one DFO noted during those meetings last week, hey, I'm not trying to beat you for a kid on the recruiting trail. I'm trying to do my job to the best of the ability, and the mistakes we make or the obstacles we encounter can perhaps help you, or vice versa. So to me, it's one of the more collegial atmospheres that we're around at some of these events. It's more informative, in my opinion, than AFCA in terms of the long-reaching and year-long benefits. So tons of topics to discuss: transfer portal windows, the calendar, how much is that going to be affected moving forward, what's going on with the NFL and the NCAA's relationships as it pertains to college football, on and on, Zach. We've got a number of topics that we'll get to plow through today.
Yeah, I went to, I believe it was the, might have been the first one. It was here in the Metroplex in 2014, and they did it here because the first college football playoff championship game was going to be here. And then it might have moved around, but it's found a pretty much a permanent home in Frisco, where it's been the last few years. And the number of people that have attended has grown. The number of vendors outside in the hallway seems to be bigger every year. So it seems to be a fruitful event for all involved. And fortunately for you and I, the number of media in this has not grown. So let's see if we can keep all that the same. So you and I think I was sitting next to you when you were typing furiously, taking notes on a discussion, panel discussion between, there was an NCAA high-level staff member, there was a third party who works in that vendor, a couple of third-party vendors who work in the NIL space, best to put it, and a couple school personnels, basically talking about how do we handle this, where we are in NIL right now. So why don't you lead us through that discussion?
Yeah, super enlightening panel, because you had a couple of basically conference commissioners or deputy conference commissioners, or three deputy conference commissioners or heads of respective conferences for football, and then also an ambassador during that initial panel discussion from the NCAA. And I just found it very enlightening how much they're talking about how far out they're working on scheduling. And obviously you've written about that today with Notre Dame and Clemson opting into a 12-year agreement. The SEC continues to discuss a nine-game conference schedule model, which would impact some other non-conference games down the road. But I just thought it was very enlightening as we looked at revenue share and you know, when we heard from one of the a power conference football commissioner who was there. Here's basically a direct quote from him talking about a revenue share and also talking about what is the future of the bowl system. So I'm just going to read all this because, I just found it so fascinating. And like you, as a college football nerd, having grown up my entire life watching bowl games, as you referenced, that 10 a.m. kickoff to the Cotton Bowl, those are some of my fondest Christmas break memories are watching bowl games. So when he was asked about what's the impact of revenue share and specifically what's it going to do to the bowl system, he said it's a great question because it's to the core of what conference offices should be doing, and that's returning as much money as possible back to the schools. We're in our conference doing this, not as much as football, but in every other sport, we're looking at every expense item, every championship format, everything the conference office touches and the decisions that are made in order to be able to return as much money as possible back to our member schools. Then he followed up and said, I had an AD say this to me in December. What's the value of the bowl system moving forward? Because I didn't realize this, Zach. I don't know if you did. All the bowl contracts, he indicated, expire at the end of this current football season. After the so all the postseason bowls apparently are coming up for contract again after the 2025 season. And he said, he asked, is there still value in a 6-6 team going to a bowl game? It's $1 million expense. So is that $1 million better spent in the portal? You could go buy a quarterback for $1 million. So keeping that in mind, how can we return every dollar to you? And there's some rules that we can't get into. He said, we can't have direct contact with vendors, not football per se, but basketball, volleyball, baseball, so on are perfect examples. In the players era of the winning team in basketball got paid approximately $100,000 for NIL. So I think about entering those agreements going forward, those third-party agreements. Will it include bowl games? How might there be some NIL components to bowl games moving forward? But he said, ultimately, the AD said, yeah, the experience of going to a bowl game is still worth $1 million at a 6-6 record because it strikes to the fabric of what college athletics is supposed to be about and the experience for the entire roster, not just enriching an individual. So having read all that and talked too long, Zach, kind of you would share your thoughts on those topics.
One thing I something you said there that jumped out at me intersected to something I had written down, and that is I won't use names here, but there was a Conference USA school that said their entire defensive line went to the Power Four, transferred out, and those guys were getting $3 million collectively in their NIL deals. And he was kind of just like, well, where's our cut of that? We should get a transfer fee, similar to what you see in European soccer. And that led me into, you know, one of the overarching conversations in college football is how do we move this from a semi-professional model to a full-on professional model where you can have standardized things like that. And an Ohio State would have to pay a Kent State a fee for going out and serving as their feeder school. They're unofficially doing that. Ohio State pays 10%, 25%, whatever, of that buyout to that school, and Ohio State wins, Kent State wins, and the players win at the same time. It seems so easy, but sitting in that panel, it seemed like the idea of professionalization is not anywhere closer than I or many others would like to believe. I have one quote written down saying that, setting aside everything else, the idea of long-term liability makes it unviable. Quote, I have from one expert on the topic, quote, my long-term disability is going to drain your resources. So what was your takeaway from that area of discussion?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, and I'm looking for my exact notes on it. You're right. It was this group of five DFO that was in the audience or in attendance, not on the panel, but a participant from the crowd. So we lost 60 players this year. Now we made it, you know, we advanced in the postseason. We had a really good season, but we lost 60 players. That was, quote, a perfect storm of seniors, good players, but our entire defensive line went to the Power Four. Our guys that left us signed over $3 million in contracts. We have got to have it to get more players. It meaning money. We're a feeder system. We're right now, we're running out of money. And replacing 60 players, we don't have the money to replace 60 players. If we can, we're going to put buyouts in there to stop you guys from coming and getting our players. And that drew some laughs. But also on your point, and one of the panelists, and he's written a great book. He's been a regular participant. I don't think there's any harm in identifying him as Dr. Sherman Morris, who I believe played at LSU. And he talked about it, and he had some really good insight on the fact that in 1948, the NCAA could have handled this all differently and had student athletes as employees back then, and just said it will not work now because of the liability insurance and how much it would drain on schools, and the fact that it's not financially feasible in this model to have them become employees because of the liability insurance. That was the main thing that I took away from. I think also it was important to note that I think all three of those conference ambassadors that we heard from, as well as countless DFOs, we weren't told, all those people unanimously said they have not had a single student athlete come to them and say, we want to be employees. Now, I'm sure some people out there want to be considered employees and believe that the overall benefits of becoming employees of the school would outweigh the hassles in terms of paperwork and the way it would change things and the dynamics to their schedule. But that's the second year in a row that has been discussed at those DFO meetings, Zach, and that the overwhelming consensus has been that student athletes do not wish to become employees.
And of course, why they have all the power right now. So on top of the on the ground logistics, the logistical challenge of getting 10, 20,000 18 to 22 year olds or 18 to 27 year olds into one group that could actually represent them in any meaningful way. That's one challenge. And then two, getting them to sign something that puts them in a less advantageous situation is a challenge all its own. I talked to Dr. Morris afterwards just because I was from a perspective of just educate me.
Right.
The unfrozen caveman lawyer, it seems so simple to me. What do I not know? If I'm Missouri, can't I have my football, basketball, women's basketball players sign one document that says I play for Tiger Athletics Inc. and I am an affiliate of the University of Missouri, but I'm not a student athlete of the University of Missouri. I am a employee of Tiger Athletics Inc. And then if I play tennis or golf or you name it, now I sign my traditional scholarship paper and I am a student athlete, non-employee of the University of Missouri. Can't that happen? And Dr. Morris basically laughed in my face. Now, he's much kinder than that, but it's basically said that's a lawsuit, that's discrimination, that's a lawsuit waiting to happen. So there's a whole conversation there to be had that we don't have time for. But for me, my overarching takeaway on that front was it is not nearly as close to a reality of professionalizing, turning athletes into employees as I assumed that it was.
Yeah, no, leaving those meetings, I got the sense, very similar to you, that it's not close, that they will continue with this system. Now they are quick to point out the flaws in this system and the fact that if the House settlement passes and it could be ruled on while we're recording this podcast and U.S. District Court Judge Claudia Wilkin could finally push it through because the sides bring her roster modifications and agree to phase in some of those roster changes that they've already agreed to. But it's not close, and it doesn't seem like it's really on the verge of happening. And I thought the liability component was as telling as anything. And Dr. Morris talking about how much there's liability is a huge component. Also, the fact that the current collegiate model is a complete free-for-all right now. But if that House settlement passes and there's revenue sharing officially enacted by July 1, that in theory, there's going to be some more guardrails. And he posed the questions, and other panelists said, Zach, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, that a holdout is coming from a college football player or multiple college football players. They predicted as soon as this fall because of NIL disagreements. Just were you shocked to hear that? What are your thoughts on the potential of a college football player staging a, quote, NIL holdout?
Yeah, this is a hot topic considering the Nico deal, and depending on what you read, he was threatening a holdout of Tennessee's game against Ohio State in the playoff this past year. But the NCAA representative said he talked to multiple agents who spoke as if it was a fact that they know exactly when their client has the most leverage over the over their school, and they were planning on at least threatening a holdout before those dates. Presumably before the first round, quarterfinal, semifinal, national championship, you name it, coming December and January. Let's talk more about agents here, because there was a general consensus in the room that the frustration of player movement within the DFOs and then the professionals within college football is not necessarily with the players themselves. I heard so many people say that it's the parents and the and or the agent that are shopping these kids, and a lot of times it's news to the kid that they're leaving, and they don't really have much of a choice a lot of the time in their movements.
Yeah, and so one of the key questions posed is, do they favor agent certification? And overwhelmingly, I think you and I both craned our necks around the room because like good students, we were sitting in the front row. We craned our necks around the room to get an idea of what the consensus was. And there's strong support to see the NCAA put together and craft with its member institutions a agent certification program on the college football side of, specifically to the college football side of things, but as it pertains to NIL as a whole. And the NCAA representatives pointed out, hey, we did this in 2019 for college basketball for their early entrance. And while initially there was hesitancy and some agents said they were going to boycott, they said now in this most recent batch of college basketball players declaring for the NBA, they had unanimous certification of all the players' agent representation. So I do think that's a key step forward in this process. I think you've got some collectives out there that take far too big of a chunk of money from the individuals. I know an agent based out of LA that I respect tremendously who takes a flat 5% fee no matter what, unless it's not even if it's a smaller figure. If it's a $100,000 deal, he's not taking a 5% fee. But then there are agents out there, and the NCAA said they had direct evidence of this, that there are agents out there taking 20, 25, and in some instances they said they had seen a 30% fee imposed by the agents for some of these NIL deals.
Yeah, it was eye-opening. And one, I guess, human example that came up was a player going into a senior year that had been in his school since high school and had been offered a sum of money to transfer. This guy was not a likely NFL player and was going into his final year of eligibility, but was going to need to stay in school for the spring of his senior year after his football season's over to complete his degree. And the DFL was kind of explaining the situation to him, like, look, man, they're going to pay you more money, but they're not, once you're done with football, they're not going to pay you to go to school and go actually get your degree. So is that really worth it to you to stay here for less money now, but we're going to pay for your school for your spring of your senior year. You'll leave here with a good amount of money and a degree. Or do you want to leave and take a larger chunk now, but then you're on your own from that point forward? And the player, of course, left. It was basically treated as fait accompli across the room that when players get offered more money somewhere, I would say 97% of the time they're gone.
Yeah, and the room probably made it seem like it was more than 99% of the time we're gone. And while we're in this topic, I do want to circle back around. I did find the exact quote here from the meetings, and it just said, look, the numbers have gone up, but the money hasn't. June 30th is the end. A lot of your memberships and colleagues, that's their plan. They're giving players a bunch of money on paper from the collective, but that LLC is going to go bankrupt after revenue sharing kicks in. That's what the person is saying. I'm reading a direct quote. The numbers are large this year, but the goal next year is to have those numbers drop to stay under the quote-unquote cap, which you can't call it a cap. That's illegal. You can't call it a cap because then that implies collusion and all these other things and implies that there's a set scale that everyone's operating from, and that's just not the case. But they believe very strongly that collectives are more than ever overpromising right now, knowing that if the House settlement passes and the judge has said she'll pass it as soon as a couple of concessions are made, that these changes are going to come and that the coaches are going to be the ones saying, well, the collective promised you and now the collective's out of money. And so here, continuing the quote, some kids ain't going to play who was supposed to be making $2.5 million and now they're only going to make $500,000. I'm telling you this because agents have told me this. They're plotting to hold their kids out at the most desperate times in order to play. What's going to happen when they see that renegotiated contract and it ain't $2.5 million from the collective, it's $500,000 from the school and the revenue sharing? Agents are telling me already to get ready during bowl season or whatever for holdouts from very prominent players.
Let's stay on this topic because we were just discussing before we went on. There's been a significant, due to agents and their interaction with school, that a standard of the NFL draft process is going away. What is that and why?
Yeah, so the CAC program, which is the Collegiate Advisory Council, I believe it is. I think I've got that acronym proper. I'm jumping all over my notes, so let me get back down here to it just because I want to use the proper term in talking about it. But the CAC is going away, and that is because of the presence of agents. And they said in these meetings, quote, for the last 15 years, we've had the CAC, we've had this Collegiate Advisory Council where NFL people got into rooms, whether it was GMs or lead scouts or top front office personnel, even I think some coaches from time to time, and schools could submit a half dozen names that they wanted the NFL to look at in order to try and project a grade. And in recent years, that had been streamlined even more. You used to be able to maybe get up to a grade, a fourth or fifth round grade, depending on who you talk to. But in more recent years, they went to a much narrower scope, Zach, and it was either you got a first or second round grade or you got told to go back to school. There was no in between. Well, the NCAA and the NFL are scheduled to meet this fall and discuss this program some more, but the Collegiate Advisory Committee is going away, and the reason is because what we have seen, quote, the last 3 to 4 years, schools have submitted their kids, and then the kids turn around and use those evaluations from the NFL to hold their schools hostage. So they're canceling the program because they don't want to give a grade that says first or second round to a player, and that player turns around and uses it to hold a school hostage or uses it to justify leaving one school and holds a new school hostage to get much larger money because they've had this NFL grade assigned to them, or in theory assigned to them.
Yeah. That goes back to the, even if you had professionalization and collective bargaining, the players have all the leverage right now. So what would they give up, and what could incentivize them to give up all this leverage that they have right now? I frankly think we're further away from that than the average person believes.
Yeah, I think so. And one other thing to note that neither of us realized, and it was during these same discussions, is that Zach and I didn't know, and I feel like you and I are fairly well educated on college football and the nuances. And we know that you can't declare for the NFL draft till you're 3 years removed from high school. Well, yeah, that's right. After your third year being out of high school, you have to opt into the NFL draft. What I didn't realize, Zach, is that after your fourth year, you have to opt out of the draft. If you're staying in school after your fourth year, you have to notify the NFL that you do not wish to be considered for the NFL draft, or it was called a passive draft if he's 4 years removed and did not opt out. An NFL team could decide it likes you and still draft you even if you had not declared for the draft because you had not opted out of the draft. So that was a topic that they were looking at very strongly to see if they want to keep that the same way or if they want to make it where you automatically have to opt in if you still have eligibility left at the collegiate level or what. But I did not realize that, Zach. I did not realize that after your fourth year of college, even if you're a redshirt junior, you have to opt out of the NFL draft.
Yeah, I had absolutely no idea about that. On the transfer portal, one note I had written down, as agents are getting more shrewd, schools and collectives are also getting more shrewd. It seems pretty standard practice within the industry now to build in signing bonuses and retention bonuses to these NIL contracts around portal dates. Like if it was the portal closed on the 25th, and most every school these days is sending out their signing bonus or retention bonus on the 26th in a way to, I guess, depending on how you view it, either quote unquote entrap players or incentivize them to make the right decision and not hop into the portal for a place that doesn't care as much about them.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. It's smart on the part of the colleges. I think it's very smart to have those incentives tied in. And look, I think it was indicated to me Notre Dame took a very similar approach in incentivizing guys because Notre Dame did not have any players opt into the transfer portal back in December once it opened and Notre Dame was in the midst of its playoff run. And they lost overall very few players in general, but they did not have anybody opt into the NCAA transfer portal from the time that the playoff seeding was announced until they had culminated their run and lost to Ohio State in the national championship contest. So there were some incentives there at play, I was told. That makes sense that these schools are doing that more and more. The other thing we heard a lot about, Zach, and we could probably take this podcast on for 2 hours as much as we learned, but I know we need to be winding toward a close here. We heard a lot about the buyouts in contracts, and we heard how many schools are putting buyouts in and how many schools intend to enforce it. And there were more support for enforcing buyouts than not, but there were some interesting components that were brought to attention that the panelists urged them to consider if they decide to go down this road of pursuing a buyout against a player.
Yeah, I think a lot of eyes are on the Madden Iamaliava situation after he left Arkansas for UCLA without ever playing a down for the Hogs.
Yes, you're exactly right. And so what they were saying on buyouts was, here's another direct quote from the NCAA. Are you really implementing that? Are you really going to challenge a kid and take him to court for breaching contract? Or are you going to leave it to other schools? Maybe some are going to put exclusive clauses on that next school that you can't use that player's name, image, and likeness because the previous school still owns it. They said that had actually already happened. And kids are then not disclosing the contracts to the school. So is the buyout there to scare them, or are you there to really enforce it? And one school said, we have the buyout in, and we're going to enforce it. If a kid has $50,000 left on his NIL deal and he leaves early, he or the school he's going to has to pay the 25% buyout. I thought that was really interesting. Then they broached the topic of how far are you willing to go in this? How far are you going to take a kid to potentially take him to court over a buyout? Do you want to get to the point of discovery? And there was not a single hand in the building raised when a panelist said, how many of you think your head coach wants to get on the stand and have to testify over a breach of contract? And not a single arm in the room was raised, Zach.
So we're nearly 30 minutes into this headache-inducing and at times, frankly, gross conversation around money in college football. And then, oh, by the way, these DFOs also have incredibly complex, complicated jobs outside of all this that has only gotten bigger as college football has grown. And this was most of what we've discussed has been just been within one hour of what was 2.5 days of meetings. And just to touch on some of the other things that were discussed, there was a presentation from a Power Four staffer who basically serves as the COO of a tens of million dollars organization that has more than 250 staff, more than 100 full-time people that don't report to him, but he's their first contact for, my rent check didn't come. Can you fix this? Hey, my hotel key doesn't work. Can you fix this? Hey, there's an arrest. You're the first call. You're the point of contact for the head coach, the coaching staff, the players, all the different vendors that you have that a college football program has on campus, off campus. You're traveling a small army to and from schools or locations six, seven times a year. It is a incredibly demanding, but also incredibly rewarding job that these people do. There was another presenter who went in through everything. I'm going to be writing more about this, of everything that you should do in your first 30 to 60 days on campus as a DFO, who opened his presentation by saying there's two people who can affect the life of every single person in your building. That's the head coach and that's the DFO. And so if you're sitting here watching John and I talk, saying, why would anyone do this? That's still why. It's still college football at the end of the day. It's still the greatest game in the world. And there's still people working these jobs who get into this because they love the game, they love kids, and they want to affect lives.
Yeah, and I wrote about this in our story yesterday on Football Scoop, our initial offering coming out of the meetings. And so I'll shamelessly plug that story in this podcast right now. But doubling back, it ties in with all this, the agent certification, whether or not there's going to be a certification program moving forward for agents who are representing NCAA student athletes, particularly college football players in the world of NIL. And I do find these statistics incredibly enlightening, and we already talked about it. Well, first of all, they were encouraging people to go to their state and local officials to talk to your head coaches, talk to state officials, talk to local officials, and tell them you want agent certification. There is an appetite for that. They said there was a 45% increase in agent activities this year in terms of kids in the portal who were telling schools that they have an agent and that their agent is, quote, going to do the dirty work. And we saw, this is again coming from a panelist, we saw agents sending out lists to staff before the season ever ended. That's where a lot of the tampering is coming from. The agents are dictating this market. And another prominent DFO who was a panelist and who spoke and who had some really innovative ideas to help his program said, the agent thing is a major problem. It's a major issue. It's been the root of us losing a lot of guys. Agents are sliding into DMs and selling these kids on a dream. And how much financial gain is it really for at the end of the day for this? They do forget the academic component that's getting lost in all this. And you touched on that earlier, Zach, with a great anecdotal point about multiple players leaving who were literally a semester shy of graduation. Now they're gone. And are they going to come back to that school and finish their degree? If so, they're not going to have their degree paid for by that school. They'll have to pay out of pocket for that final semester of education.
So if we're to put a bow on this, I think the professionalization of college football, NIL, making players employees, collective bargaining, I think it's not as simple and not near as close as the layman would believe. But if there's one thing that we could do, obviously the House settlement is, we'll see if that's able to bring some sanity into that. One thing that it could bring a lot of sanity to college football is actually making sure that agents are professionals and not just somebody's uncle.
Yeah, that's one of the overarching themes that I carried with me back home to South Bend from Frisco once I made it through all the thunderstorms and actually got to take off after spending what felt like 4 weeks during 6 hours inside DFW.
Yeah, John and pretty much everyone else who came to Dallas last week went through hell getting and leaving Dallas. But it was great once you actually got here, right, John?
Anything for our faithful coaches and audience of Football Scoop.
All right, that's the Football Scoop podcast, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.